Okay, our next and last case for argument is Apex Digital versus Sears Roebuck. Ms. Murphy?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Siobhan Murphy representing Apex Digital, plaintiff appellant below. The fundamental issue presented to the Court in this case today is the application of controlling United States Supreme Court decision in Defenders of Wildlife.
Well, where is CIT in all this?
Well, CIT today or CIT at the time we were first before judgment.
It's very strange that there's nothing in the briefs about the nature of its interest. Well, what's going on?
Well, let me back up and provide you some background explanation as to what happened with regard to CIT. I have to go outside of the record to do
that.
Why
do you have to go outside the record? I would have thought that in trying to preserve your case, you would have to explain the role of CIT.
Well, I think argument...
If someone buys debt from someone else, you know, buys a receivable from someone, then he owns it, and the seller of the receivable drops out. So it's very puzzling to have the seller of the receivable bringing this suit to enforce the receivable. And you wonder, well, wait, you sold it, so... what's the buyer doing? I don't understand.
I think we're combining two questions, Your Honor, and I'd like to take them one at a time. The first question that you're really asking...
Look, if I sell you my car and the car is damaged, I don't sue the person who damaged the car. I sold it.
Your
Honor,
that's correct.
Now, why isn't this case identical, at least as far as one judges from the briefs?
Your Honor, if I may, commercial factoring agreements frequently have... words like
not
sale.
Frequently have. What is the agreement here?
The agreement here, provided
the
CIT would act.
Is it in the record?
It is not.
Why isn't it in the record?
Because the litigant.
How can you argue that you have retained some interest in this $8 million receivable when the evidence of that interest is nowhere in the record?
Well, you have two issues here, Your Honor. And I think I do have to take them separately. I cannot fully address the litigation decisions of counsel who first made that decision, because I was not that counsel. But I do know...
It doesn't make the slightest difference.
But I do know,
right?
That there were...
It doesn't make any difference.
I think it does.
The lawyer botches the case.
Well, you're not...
You can't turn it over to someone else who says, well, it's botched by someone else, so...
But I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying that there was a point in this case when this issue was raised, and it was specifically raised at the pleading stage of the case. And that language is from the United States Supreme Court decision in Defenders of Wildlife, which set forth the standard that the plaintiff must meet to prove standing at each progressive stage.
No, that's a complete misunderstanding, because if a defendant presents evidence or argument to suggest that there is no standing, the plaintiff can't just rest on language in Supreme Court decisions. He has to show, no, there really is standing. It looks bad, you know, but actually, and then you have an evidentiary hearing to determine whether there's standing.
Well, Your Honor, I think that a party can reasonably rely on...
No, can't.
Well, let me
explain. Absolutely cannot. Because if a defendant challenges standing, and it's a colorable challenge and has an evidentiary basis, the plaintiff cannot remain mum. The plaintiff has to show, no, there is standing.
But to reach that point, Your Honor, the court must disregard the language chosen by the United States Supreme Court in setting forth that there is, in fact, a progressive process to litigation. You have three stages that are recognized by the Supreme Court.
Suppose you have a diversity suit and you allege the defendant is a citizen of Iowa, and the defendant presents a bunch of evidence to the court and says, look, I've never been in Iowa, I live in Illinois, driver's license, voting registration, everything. Do you think the plaintiff can just say, well, you know, I assert that he's a citizen of Iowa, and we'll determine that at the trial? No, he has to present evidence.
I think that the plaintiff in that circumstance If the motion at issue is a motion brought as the first filing in the case, which is exactly where we are, may reasonably rely on
this. No, because the whole point is to get the issue of subject matter jurisdiction decided immediately. So the defendant, the plaintiff can't say, well, you say you're not a citizen of Iowa, but I want to do my discovery and my this and my that and my other thing on the merits, and then later, you know, at some point you can raise the standing issue. No, standing has to be determined at the beginning.
Let me go back to your hypothetical citizenship in Iowa. Let's say, for example, the defendant steps into court as their first motion, 12B6, 12B1 combined motion, which is what we had here, and says, I'm not a citizen of Iowa because I give you an affidavit that I don't live in Iowa. But the affidavit does not address other facts that could properly establish an Iowa presence, that could properly establish that there's jurisdiction in the court. It's completely silent on the defendant's ownership of land in Iowa, completely silent on defendant's operation of a business in Iowa, completely silent on all of these other key material facts that might show that there is, in fact, jurisdiction. And by that analogy, I think that the plaintiff could come in and say, what you've submitted as evidence is an incomplete rebuttal of the statements we've put in our complaint, which is exactly the situation we have here. Apex comes in.
Looks like a complete rebuttal to me. It looks as if Apex has no interest in this case.
But to reach that conclusion, Your Honor, one has to ignore Illinois' case law about what happens when you have a collections agent hired. One also has to ignore a body of case law in the federal courts.
Why do you call a collection agent? Looks like an assignment.
It looks like an assignment, but that's not always the case, Your Honor.
Of course, it's not always the case. So if they present something which creates a real doubt in a judge's mind whether there's standing, then you can't just sit. You have to present some evidence.
And had the court here done what is recognized as required for a 12B6 motion to move to the evidentiary standing, and said to Apex, I think this, you're wrong about the standard I'm going to apply. I'm going to move beyond the standard that the Supreme Court says applies at the pleading stage of the case, and I'm going to go to evidence. And given Apex that order, the next step would have been an evidentiary proceeding comparable to...
You should have presented it to us. Because, look, you just look at this, it looks as if you have no interest, zero interest. CIT, no one has heard from CIT.
You have a second case pending in the district court?
We do, Your Honor.
Based on an assignment back to Apex from CIT?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't you pursue that, and why are you prosecuting this appeal?
We are prosecuting this appeal solely because Sears maintained in response to our initial motion to dismiss this appeal as moot that they were going to raise a statute of limitations argument, essentially asserting that in the time frame it took us to work through the issues with CIT and get the reassignment, we would have lost some of the claims.
Right.
And
Like
any trial attorney, we don't want to lose any of the arrows in our quiver that we don't believe that's the case.
In response to Judge Kaney, confirms this case is moot. You needed a reassignment in order to have standing.
If, in fact, there is a statute of limitations issue that Sears can raise in the second filed case, then the existence of this case is not moot.
Of course it is. This case, if you had no standing to bring this case, the case is dead. If you have a statute of limitations problem because you brought the suit prematurely when you didn't own the cause of action, well, tough luck.
But that presumes, Your Honor, that the decision below was correct. And we submit that a party should not be...
You just said it's correct. You'd assigned it. You'd assigned it and you needed a reassignment.
No, what we did, Your Honor, was to take some action to make a very clear reassignment. We never said, and we do not agree, that the assignment from...
You should have told the district court that.
Your Honor. Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about this other suit that you mentioned to Judge Kaney? Who are the parties and what is the contention?
The parties to the other suit that subsequently filed are Apex and Sears. The intention of that suit is to collect the same $8 million that is due to Apex from Sears and that Sears never contended it paid. The difference in the two cases is only that we took action to cure the perceived defect in standing in order to come into court. I do not think, and I really don't want to walk away from the court without making this point.
Please make your point. I do have another question.
The fact of the matter is, every single Seventh Circuit case that's been cited to the court by either side here is consistent with the Defenders of Wildlife progression between the burden that should be on a party at the pleading stage, the burden at summary judgment, and the burden at trial. The burden at the pleading stage, and there is no, words may have fuzzy edges, but there is a core of meaning of the pleading stage, and that core of meaning necessarily has to mean the first motion to dismiss filed in response to a complaint. What we said to the court below, and I think correctly, was that the document they filed, which is a single document of only two paragraphs, does not provide a complete explanation. There is clear Illinois case law recognizing an equitable cause of action for the party that assigned its accounts for collection to itself sue. And that Illinois case law was never addressed below, but is sufficient to establish that our equitable cause of action, which was pled, was live and stated standing. Standing is
Judge Ripple has a question for you.
I apologize. Sorry?
Never mind. Let's go back to your present litigation.
Okay.
Do you perceive, Ms. Murphy, that there is a question, a difference, a factual difference between your position and the position of the opposition, or is there a legal difference?
I think there's a legal difference.
Thank you.
And if I may briefly
conclude. Your time has expired.
If I may briefly conclude, or shall I come back on my rebuttal?
I'll give you a minute afterwards, after we hear from Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. John Walker for Appley Sears. I'm not really going to spend any time on the applicable legal standard. I think the court correctly apprehends it. There's a factual challenge to standing here, and the district court was properly able to consider
What's
evidence.
What's the factual challenge?
I'm sorry?
Factual challenge?
Correct, a factual...
What is the factual challenge? What's the difference in fact between you and Ms. Murphy? What are you disputing factually here?
Well, the factual challenge is that Sears had a letter in its file from Apex's president, Mr. G, stating unequivocally that the accounts that Apex was suing under had been, quote, sold and assigned, end quote, to CIT.
Do they dispute the existence of that letter?
No, they don't dispute the existence of it.
So they only dispute the significance of that letter?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The legal significance of that letter?
Well, they dispute the legal significance, I suppose, but the letter is unambiguous.
So there's a real dispute between you and Ms. Murphy about the legal significance of that letter.
We say it's a factual dispute.
I know you say
right.
that. But she says she has a right to the money that your client has, and you say she doesn't.
Correct.
Sounds like that's a case in controversy, doesn't it?
Well, put that way, I agree with you that there's
And you say there's no legal right under the commercial law of the state of Illinois for you to have to give that money to her, right?
Absolutely. Right. Given the assignment. Correct.
Why is that not a 12B6 issue?
Well, because 12B1 allows a factual challenge to standing, Your Honor.
But I thought we just discussed the fact that's a legal problem we have here.
Well, there can be a legal effect that comes from a factual finding, and perhaps that's the best way to answer the court's question.
It sounds like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think so. No, in the context of a 12B1 motion, which we expressly moved under, and Judge Lindberg granted the motion under 12B1, the factual the contest was required Apex to come forward with evidence.
A lot of these cases coming through now, standing is getting sexy, and everybody wants to get rid. Defendants want to get rid of cases real fast, slam them right out the door, no standing. But you're making the judge take a peek at the merits of the dispute to do it, right?
Not in
you're
this case.
Why are you not?
We don't challenge any of the elements of the claims that Apex pled. If we had come forward with, say, a disguised summary judgment motion under 12B1
How about
saying that one
disguised 12B6?
Well, no, Your Honor. I completely disagree. There are cases that say that a 12B1 motion isn't an appropriate way, it's not an appropriate way to attack, let's say, an element of a cause of action. That's not this case. Our challenge went to whether or not Apex was the appropriate party to be before the court. And there are a number of cases, including several that the Seventh Circuit has decided, where factual challenges to standing are upheld.
I understand your position. Thank you, Mr. Moore.
Where are you in that second litigation?
I'm not handling the second litigation, Your Honor. My understanding is it was filed in March, and that I believe there's been an answer, but I think it's in its very nascent stages. Okay. So our position, as outlined in our papers, is that once we brought the factual challenge to standing to the court, that it was Apex's obligation to come forward with some competent proof to show by a preponderance of the evidence that it had standing. And in this case, that evidence was uniquely in Apex's within Apex's ability to present, because David G., who presented the letter that Apex Sears relied on for its motion, is Apex's president and could have come forward with a declaration attaching the underlying agreement between CIT and Apex, setting forth what the exact nature of the assignment was, and they could have cleared that up with competent proof, but they didn't do so. They
so
also didn't
what
go to
they
CIT
could have done is present that claim that under Illinois law that they could still bring an action if that's what the underlying contract provided.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
If they brought the original assignment, the contract language between Apex and CIT, and it had some language that met the Illinois law with regard to their ability to pursue the action.
Absolutely, right. And that also would have been appropriate. But it was incumbent upon Apex to bring that material to Judge Lindbergh. They came forward with nothing. So under the NLFC case and others like it decided in the Seventh Circuit, they completely failed to meet their burden of proof, and the underlying decision to dismiss their complaint was appropriate. And unless there are further questions, that concludes my argument.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Walker. I'll give you a minute, Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to briefly address the issue of David G. in that he was not available to the defense because he was under duress in China, which was a factor that I don't want to go down the path on.
Why bring these things to the attention of the district court rather than to us?
I think what was going on at the time, this is where I wanted to sort of briefly touch on it.
Where there was so much, where everything that mattered was outside the record.
Well, for that, Your Honor, I apologize. But in terms of Sears raising the argument that David G. could have brought in, that's factually untrue. David G. was at that time not available.
Factually untrue. There's no record of that.
But there's no record that David G. was available either, which is what Sears raised.
Honestly.
Well, that said, I think I also want to go back to the facts that were presented to the court at the time. At the time, on the standard that was appropriate to a motion to dismiss, the evidence before the court did not foreclose the equitable claim that Apex had, in fact.
I actually had this case. What if you had a patent suit and the defendant says, oh, by the way, the patentee does not own that patent. It's owned by somebody else. And in the case I had, the judge said, before I was assigned the case, the judge said, well, we're going to have a hearing on that. So I had a hearing. It's true. The patentee did not own the patent. So the case was thrown out for lack of jurisdiction because you have to own a patent in order to sue for its infringement. Now, is this case any different?
Yes, in two ways. First, Illinois recognizes that an assignment of accounts receivable is a distinct issue where the assignor can retain and does retain an equitable right.
Can, yes, but there's no indication in that letter of any retention of any interest. So you'd think the judge would say, well, you know, the defendant, you've raised a colorable issue. Now let's see what the plaintiff has to say. And the plaintiff doesn't say anything.
But the plaintiff did, in fact, say that, first, the evidence that Sears submitted was an incomplete record, and second, the proper standard at that stage in the proceedings.
No, that's where you're wrong. Standing issues, when factual questions are raised, are decided first. then now you don't defer that to because the court doesn't want to do anything until it satisfies itself that it has jurisdiction.
You know, I hear you, Your Honor, but that does not comport with...
There's a zillion cases which talk about that,
but
evidentiary hearings are held at the outset of a case when a colorable issue of jurisdiction is raised.
But no evidentiary hearing was raised here. No evidentiary
because
hearing was
he
set here.
The evidence. So he just looks at the letter and he says, yeah, assigned away. Plaintiff doesn't deny that it was an assignment, doesn't present any contrary evidence.
But in fact, Your Honor, this was before the court on a 12B6, 12B1 motion. In order to convert it would have held the evidentiary hearing, which would have made a substantial difference. We wouldn't be here today. But also, Your Honor, I don't think we can read Supreme Court decisions without taking the words chosen correctly. And I do think that...
Don't you realize that there are hearings to determine jurisdiction at the outset of a case when jurisdiction is challenged?
And if an evidentiary hearing had been set, we wouldn't be here. But in case after case...
Counsel, can you tell me again why you're not pursuing or you are pursuing the case? Why are you pursuing this appeal when you have the case pending in district court?
I'm pursuing this appeal because Sears maintains that it's going to argue statute of limitation bars the second case.
So the entire amount?
They've not elucidated on what their argument would be, so we have to assume it would be the entire amount. If I may, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Murphy.
I thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Walker. And the court will be in recess.